Hello, and welcome to Medicine Matters, the Springer Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Jane Gosland. For our first foray into infectious diseases, we're heading straight into a story that is in equal measure alarming and reassuring. Stick with me, it's gonorrhea. Not something we've looked at on the podcast before, but actually a super exciting topic in 2025, and we have lots to cover. Gonorrhea infections have surged to record levels in recent years. In England alone, over 85,000 cases were reported in 2023, and that's the highest since records began in 1918. Across Europe, the incidence has more than doubled over the past decade, with young heterosexual women and men who have sex with men among the populations most affected. Compounding this crisis is the alarming rise in antimicrobial resistance, which seems to be accelerating. WHO has declared Neisseria gonorrhea to be a global priority pathogen, underscoring the urgent need for new tools in prevention and treatment. But despair not, this month, England is launching the world's first targeted gonorrhea vaccination programme. So perhaps there is reason to be reassured? Let's bring in the experts and find out what's going on.
Hello, I'm Jaz Healy, a clinical content manager with Springer Medicine. Joining me this episode is Dr. Hamish Mohammed, a consultant epidemiologist in the Division of Blood Safety, Hepatitis, STIs and HIV at the UK Health Security Agency. Dr. Mohammed, welcome.
Thank you, Jaz. It's good to be here.
Diving in with the first question, England has seen an increasing prevalence of gonorrhea since the early 2000s. Are we seeing this trend continue?
It's a good question. So in terms of gonorrhea trends, we know that gonorrhea is the second most commonly diagnosed STI in England. So to give you an order of the scale of magnitude, there are over 70,000 diagnoses of gonorrhea each year in England. There has been an increasing trend since the early 2000s for a number of different reasons. So what we know now is trends of gonorrhea have increased over the last couple of decades. We saw the highest number on record in 2023. There was a total of 85,000 diagnoses. And in England and other nations of the UK as well, we're fortunate because we have surveillance data for STIs going back over 100 years. So when I say highest number on record, records began a very long time ago, and we're seeing really high levels of gonorrhea. The epidemiology of gonorrhea is something to bear in mind because the distribution varies in terms of gender identity, sexual orientation, region. So to give you a case in point, there are more cases of gonorrhea in men compared to women. The peak age for gonorrhea in women is around the late teens or early 20s. It skews more towards the late 20s or early 30s for men. And that's due to different sexual networks, but also a reflection of the fact that about 45% of all gonorrhea diagnoses are in gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men. So again, that's a really big proportion when you bear in mind that census estimates dictate that maybe fewer than 5% of the population identifies as a gay or bisexual man. We do see geographic variation in gonorrhea. So the highest rates tend to be in urban centers and large cities such as London and Greater Manchester. And we also see a really strong link between gonorrhea and socioeconomic deprivation, such that the rates of gonorrhea are highest in the most socioeconomically deprived areas as well.
And what of antibiotic-resistant cases? In 2015, England reported its first case of ketoxone-resistant gonorrhea. Has the number of reported cases risen since then?
What has changed is that we're detecting cases at a greater frequency. So you're right in saying that the first time we detected a ceftriaxone-resistant strain of Neisseria gonorrhea, that's the bacteria that causes gonorrhea, that was back in 2015. We then saw a slow trickle of cases over the next few years, and then that rate of detection slowly crept up to roughly 2 cases per year. And then after the cessation of lockdowns to control COVID-19 in 2021 and the resumption of international travel, the rate of detection increased from 2 per year to 2 per month. So we saw 12 to 14 cases in 2024, but just for the first 5 to 6 months of 2025, we've already seen more than the total for last year. So again, we're seeing small numbers, but the rate of detection is increasing. And it's worth bearing in mind that I'm talking about 14 cases in 2024 against a backdrop of 70,000 plus gonorrhea diagnoses. So most gonorrhea infections are treatable. We are worried in particular about ceftriaxone resistance because the currently recommended first-line antibiotic for gonorrhea is ceftriaxone. Ceftriaxone belongs to a class of antibiotics called cephalosporins, and cephalosporins are the last remaining class of antibiotics available to treat gonorrhea. There is something really quite agile about the bacterium that causes gonorrhea, and it's developed resistance to every class of antibiotics used to treat it in the past, which is why it's really important to make sure we keep ceftriaxone as a viable treatment option for empirical monotherapy.
Looking beyond England for the moment, how does it compare globally in terms of gonorrhea incidence and resistance patterns?
I'll talk a bit about gonorrhea incidence. So that trend I described in terms of an increases in diagnoses over the last couple of decades is not unique to England. So there are different countries, and what we find is particularly in high-income countries, they have comparable public health surveillance systems to what we have in England. So we know, as a case in point, in the most of Western Europe, in the United States, in many states, and in Canada as well, and in Australia and New Zealand, we've seen a rising trend in gonorrhea for quite some time. The epidemiology is also quite similar. Now, I will say this to put things in context and do this comparison with the utmost caution. The public health surveillance in England is quite robust and comprehensive because there is a network of open access sexual health services. There's a unique genitourinary medicine speciality, and their healthcare practitioners trained in that speciality. These sexual health services provide care anonymously if people choose not to give their names or any other personal details. So in my view, that facilitates access and promotes more testing because sadly, there's a lot of stigma on STIs. So as a result of this high level of service provision and the really rich surveillance data that we collected at the UK Health Security Agency, we are better at ascertaining cases of gonorrhea. So in other words, the trends are similar in England compared to a number of other countries, but the number of diagnoses in England is large in comparison to many other countries because of the levels of service provision and the completeness of the surveillance data. So to put some numbers on that, in 2023, we had that 85,000, that's the highest annual total since records began in 1918. So that's 85,000 gonorrhea diagnoses in a year. That number exceeded the total for all the countries in Europe that report to the European Centres for Disease Control and Prevention. So that is nothing to do with England having a particular problem with gonorrhea. The gonorrhea is a problem globally. It's just that different countries have different scale and comprehensiveness of their public health data.
You've touched on a really interesting topic there. Disease surveillance is particularly important in management of infectious diseases. How does this work in terms of sexually transmitted ones? STIs are something patients may be hesitant to see a clinician for. Does this add to the challenge of tracking these cases?
There certainly are challenges because sadly, there is still a lot of stigma associated with STIs. Sadly, there's still a lot of stigma associated with gender and sexual minorities. And these might create barriers to come forward to access testing for STIs, but interventions to prevent STIs. However, there is something really quite unique about the service provision in England and the other nations of the United Kingdom, such that, as I've alluded to, there is this network of open access, anonymous care providers. So people do not have to share proof of residence, they don't have to give their full name. And we know from stakeholders that this facilitates accessing services and testing and vaccinations, such as vaccinations for Mpox or human papillomavirus. But of course, we don't know what we don't measure in our data. So there will be marginalized communities that for a number of reasons will find it difficult to access services. So it's just to say that there are a lot of positives in terms of the service provision landscape in England. It's been under a lot of pressure given demands on services and pressures on funding in recent years. But it's really quite impressive the efforts that sexual health services take to provide services to their service users.
Global travel can have a significant impact on the epidemiology of infectious diseases. Have we seen this with gonorrhea cases in England?
You're right in saying that there's a very strong link between travel and a number of different infections. Some refer to this as the world being flat, and I'm not saying the world is certainly round, but it's just a colloquial expression to say how interconnected we are. One thing I will say is that the ceftriaxone-resistant cases that we detect in England and the rest of the UK, there is a strong link to travel, in particular to the Asia-Pacific. There's gonorrhea resistance everywhere in the globe. The patterns of resistance do vary. There are high levels of resistance in England as well. But in the Asia-Pacific region in particular, there are high levels of resistance to ceftriaxone. So to recap, travel is important. Most of the ceftriaxone-resistant cases we've detected in England have been linked to travel. And in terms of what we do in response to that, there are a number of things that we can do. So for instance, we work with travel health providers to give some really clear, succinct messages about reducing the risk of STIs while overseas, anywhere in the world in particular, right? Just to make sure that you take the right measures, such as condom use, testing when there's a need, to raise awareness of STIs, but also make sure people know how to reduce the risk of any sexually transmitted infection. The other way that we look at it in terms of our public health actions is that we rely on multiple streams of information to monitor as quickly as we can any cases of ceftriaxone resistance. So as a case in point, we have a system that's been running since the year 2000 called the Gonorrhea Resistance to Antimicrobial Surveillance Program, or GRASP. That takes a number of isolates from sexual health services, about 20 or 25, a couple of months each year, and that gives us really rich data on trends in antimicrobial resistance. However, that is not as timely as some other sources of information. So we work very closely with our clinical stakeholders in sexual health services, and they do refer any suspected treatment failures for gonorrhea to us, both for clinical advice by our consultant microbiologist, her name is Dr. Helen Pfeiffer, but also the team of public health professionals are there to give advice and support in terms of follow-up actions and any contact tracing, or we refer to that as partner notifications and STIs. So to answer your question, we tackle this through a couple of different ways. One is about health promotion, awareness raising around STIs and reducing risk of STIs for travelers. And then for people who are in the UK who have had travel, if they test, if they experience symptoms, if their gonorrhea symptoms persist, or they fail treatment, those cases are referred to us for further follow-up investigations.
Moving on to preventative measures. It was announced early this year that England would be rolling out the world's first vaccination program against gonorrhea using the 4C MenB vaccine. In England, this vaccine is currently given as part of childhood vaccination programs against meningococcal disease. Could you tell us why this particular vaccine was chosen?
So we know that we're really fortunate in England to be the first country to have a national vaccination program for gonorrhea that will start in August. The initial evidence suggests that there was additional protection from a meningococcal vaccine came from Australia and New Zealand going back about maybe 8 or 9 years ago. So as part of their public health work there, they had offered adolescents the meningitis B vaccine and then followed them up over time to look at the incidence of meningococcal disease, but also the incidence of chlamydia and gonorrhea. What they found was that the gonorrhea rates decreased, but chlamydia rates didn't when you looked at vaccinated versus unvaccinated. Now, that was the first real-world observational evidence to demonstrate that a meningococcal vaccine also provides protection against gonorrhea. And the reason why that is the case is the bacteria that causes bacterial meningitis is Neisseria meningitidis. The bacteria that causes gonorrhea is another Neisseria, Neisseria gonorrhea. So they're genetically related. So as a result, it's not surprising that a vaccine that offers protection against bacterial meningitis also gives protection against gonorrhea. We know the vaccine is highly effective in protecting children against bacterial meningitis. The real-world data suggests that, and it's 4C MenB vaccine that will be used for the gonorrhea vaccination program here in England. So the real-world evidence suggests that the effectiveness of that vaccine against gonorrhea is anywhere between, say, 30 to 40%. Some estimates go as low as 22%, some as high as 47%. So it's not licensed for gonorrhea, it's licensed for bacterial meningitis, for group B meningitis. But we do know from clinical trial data and from real-world evidence that there is protection against gonorrhea. And we do need this program in place because of the very high levels of gonorrhea, but also the risks that antibiotic resistance gonorrhea poses.
Could we perhaps see an increase in asymptomatic cases due to the upcoming vaccination program?
There's no evidence to suggest that would happen. It's not that I'm aware of. So there are a couple of things that could happen. The vaccine may either protect against infection with Neisseria gonorrhea, in which case the answer is no, or it may protect against the symptoms of gonorrhea, which are, let's say, urethritis, particular discharge. So that's something we need more data on. The other thing that might come into play, and this also happens for other vaccination programs, is if there is something different about people who are likely to be vaccinated versus unvaccinated, and they're likely to have symptoms. But again, it's difficult to establish any evidence for that. Now, I say this because many people with gonorrhea won't have symptoms, in particular if they have infection in the pharynx or in the rectum. And then when you think of urethral infection, not all cases are symptomatic, but you find more men experiencing symptoms than women. And then the other added factor is that in England and many other countries as well, there is currently a testing guideline whereby people at risk, in particular, again, bisexual men at risk of STIs are advised to be tested every 3 months. So as a result, we know there's a lot of asymptomatic testing as well. So in other words, that's a long-winded way of saying I'm not aware of any evidence to say that it would skew things more towards asymptomatic people, but it's a complex system and a combination of how the vaccine works, but also whether people are motivated to seek testing after the vaccine could either introduce something genuine or something artifactual in terms of the proportion of symptomatic versus asymptomatic cases.
Looking now at treatment, earlier this year, we saw the publication of the results from the Eagle 1 Phase 3 trial, which was investigating the first-in-class antibacterial gepotidacin for treating uncomplicated urogenital gonorrhea, and it was found to be just as effective as standard treatment. This would be the first new antibiotic for gonorrhea since extended-spectrum cephalosporins in the 1990s. Could we see this becoming the standard treatment in England for antibiotic-resistant cases, or should we be perhaps focusing more on the preventive measures, such as the 4CMNB vaccine?
We need both. So that we need a combination. We have such a problem with gonorrhea. I would argue we need a combination of prevention, both through, let's say, condom use, testing when there is a need, vaccination if you're eligible with the 4CMNB vaccine. And then you've posed a really good question, because we know that Neisseria gonorrhea, the bacteria that causes gonorrhea, it's developed resistance to every class of antibiotics. So therefore, there is a global debate as to how best to use the new antibiotic classes, one of which, as you've alluded to, has received the FDA approval in the United States. So it's on the radar of the World Health Organization. It's now on radar as well. And the discussion is, like you've said, do we shift towards the novel antibiotic classes now? Do we hold them in reserve? Do we use them as part of dual therapy? So there isn't an answer yet. All of this is to be discussed. But I will say there is room for much optimism, because we've been struggling in that fight to develop novel antibiotics, so much so that the World Health Organization has classified the bacteria that causes gonorrhea as a high priority pathogen for the development of novel antibiotics. So it's really a welcome development to have those new antibiotic classes available.
That's right.
And just to clarify, just to add on to that, the novel antibiotic classes are not yet currently available in England, but that may change in the future.
If we don't take preventive action now, what could the treatment landscape look like in 5 to 10 years' time?
We've seen an increasing trend for over 20 years. So we know if we don't take action, cases won't be reduced. I can't say if it won't increase indefinitely, but we're unlikely to see a reduction in gonorrhea or a sustained reduction in gonorrhea unless we make best use of the preventive interventions that we have. So as a case in point, with the imminent start of the gonorrhea vaccination program, we hope to see a reduction in cases of gonorrhea within the next year or so. In terms of the treatment landscape, there is optimism there as well, because there's one novel antibiotic that's been approved in the US. I don't know if it's under review by the MHRA, the equivalent body in the UK, just yet. But assuming they review it and it does pass muster through the MHRA, that will then pave the way for licensed usage here in the UK as well. So in other words, we're on the cusp of a change. We've always had a mix of interventions to control STIs, with things like condoms and testing and health education, or I should say sex and reproductive health education. Now, on top of that, we have novel interventions such as 4CMNB vaccination for gonorrhea. And we also have the novel antibiotic classes as well. And as I've mentioned, there is a current debate as to how best to use those, whether to hold them in reserve or use them as part of dual therapy. So it's an exciting time, I think. And we can't predict the future, but I will say that I hope that the combination of existing and novel interventions will put us in a stronger place to reduce gonorrhea.
Dr. Mohammed, in your opinion, are there any ways in which clinicians and public health experts could better collaborate to address the growing number of not just gonorrhea cases, but other STIs in general?
I would say continuing the combination of open communication between public health, so people such as myself, my colleagues working in public health, and clinicians working on the front line, but also community groups that interact with service users and provide additional support. So it's open, transparent communication, continued rapid reporting of any suspected treatment failures, anything that seems a bit unorthodox. We are here to provide support as well. And then it's about, I would say, from a clinical perspective, co-production and collaboration on guidelines to ensure optimal care. And from a prevention perspective, it's a combination of, I would say, co-production between ourselves, clinical stakeholders, community stakeholders, to make sure that we think about our messaging, how we promote different interventions, so things like condoms, testing, partner notification, 4CMV vaccination for gonorrhea. So it will require a multi-pronged approach, but it does rely heavily on open, transparent communication and collaboration.
Unfortunately, we are coming to an end for this episode. Dr. Mohammed, we have spoken at length today on the promising outlook for gonorrhea prevention, but it has been a big year overall for STI treatments. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know about?
There is one thing I'll mention, which is the British Association for Sexual Health and HIV. This is the professional body for sexual healthcare practitioners in the United Kingdom. They have just published the UK's first guideline for doxycycline prophylaxis. Now, doxycycline is a commonly used antibiotic, and we know from recent clinical trial evidence in different countries that if you use doxycycline as post-exposure prophylaxis, by that I mean you take doxycycline after condomless sex, there is really strong evidence that it reduces the incidence of syphilis and chlamydia. Now, we haven't spoken much about this, but we also have a really big problem with syphilis in England. We've seen rising cases and the numbers of syphilis diagnoses we're seeing. So it's a different order of magnitude than gonorrhea. So there are about 9,000 to 10,000 cases of infectious syphilis each year. But don't be underwhelmed by that figure. It's the largest annual figure since the late 1940s. So syphilis is also at really high levels. So the new intervention I want listeners to be aware of is the potential for doxycycline prophylaxis to reduce the risk of syphilis. So as I've mentioned, the UK guideline has just been published. That's been led by BASH, the British Association for Sexual Health and HIV, but we've been fortunate to provide them support on that guideline as well. So in other words, the STI prevention landscape is further enhanced through that mix of the existing interventions, 4CMNB to protect against gonorrhea, but also doxycycline prophylaxis or DoxyPEP to reduce risk of syphilis.
Dr. Mohammed, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, Jens.
This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals for their ongoing medical education and entertainment. It should not replace the professional advice of a doctor or pharmacist and may not be used as a basis for diagnosis or any change to the prescribed treatment of disease. The views expressed by our moderators and guests are their opinions and do not represent the position of any third parties. The information given in the podcast is subject to change as the scientific field and clinical advances progress.